Yeah, W-O-R-T Madison.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Hello, this is the BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The European Commission has imposed large fines on the US technology giants Apple and Meta in a move that could anger President Trump at a time of wider trade disputes. Meta said the EU was forcing it to change its whole business model, likening it to a multi-billion dollar tariff. Chris Vallance has more.
As to whether there's a link to tariffs, well, the EU explicitly denies this. It remains to be seen whether the White House will see it the same way. But I think it is significant that that Meta response mentioned tariffs, and the White House has been very negative about EU fines and EU regulations. I mean, in February, it issued a memorandum that was titled Defending American Companies and Innovators from Overseas Extortion. So it'll be interesting to see the reaction from White House officials.
A long queue of mourners is filing past the open coffin of Pope Francis in St. Peter's Basilica to pay their final respects. He'll lie in state until Friday evening. Mark Lowen has more.
It's very crowded, St. Peter's Square down here, amongst the thousands of people who are queuing up to get into the Basilica to say a final farewell to Pope Francis. The Vatican says that more than 20,000 people have already filed into the Basilica to see the open coffin, which is now in front of the altar of the confession, under which it is believed lies the tomb of St. Peter. Remember, of course, that all the popes are believed to be successors to St. Peter.
The US vice president has said explicit proposals have been issued to both Russia and Ukraine as Washington pushes for an end to the war. J.D. Vance said it was time for both to agree, warning that if not, the US would walk away from the process. The Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas has said that Hamas must hand over its weapons and control of the Gaza Strip to his national authority. Mr. Abbas urged the group to release the hostages it's still holding in order to end the war. The rivalry between them goes back to 2006, when Hamas won the legislative election. From Jerusalem, Sebastian Usher has this report.
These are the strongest words Mr. Abbas has delivered since the war in Gaza erupted. The Palestinian Authority, which he heads, has regularly insisted that it's ready to take over the reins in Gaza when the war ends, but its leadership has been criticised by Palestinians for not speaking out enough or taking effective action. Now, in a furious speech in Ramallah, the PA headquarters in the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian president lashed out at Hamas. You sons of dogs, he shouted. Release the hostages and be done with it.
That was our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, reporting from Jerusalem. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC.
Literacy Network invites you to join them as they celebrate adults reaching their goals through free adult literacy education at their annual Reading Between the Lines fundraiser. From 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 24th at the Black Business Hub, you can enjoy wine tasting, hors d'oeuvres from student-owned restaurants, live mariachi, and a program that features stories from Literacy Network students and supporters, including community leader Joanne Burrish telling her own immigrant story. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, earning their GEDs, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at litnetwork.org/RBTW2025. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 20th.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Blue Stem Jazz presenting the Jimmy Ferrace Quartet at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Jimmy Ferrace's recent debut album, Hours Fly, Flowers Die, is a heartfelt narrative with themes of nostalgia and the passage of time. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 23rd, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Lindsay Kashgarian. She is the program director at the National Priorities Project, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And the National Priorities Project has released its annual tax day receipt highlighting exactly where 2024 federal income taxes went and on what those numbers say about our national spending priorities. So stay tuned to hear from Lindsay Kashgarian. Also, I'll be speaking with James Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies. Yes, James Leary is here in the studio. James Leary represents the American Folklore Society on the advisory board for the National Recording Registry of the Library of Congress. So the Library of Congress announced this year's 25 entries to the National Recording Registry just a couple of weeks ago. Among the entries were the Harry Iwata recordings of Japanese immigrant king cutters in Hawaii, the first Asian American entries to the registry. Also in the 2025 class, the Hawaiian Quintet's influential 1913 recording of Queen Liliuokalani's Aloha Oi. So stay tuned to hear from James Leary. Lots to talk about the institution and the context of this 2025's inclusion of these recordings. So stay tuned to hear from James Leary. And then later I'll be speaking with Carla Rotundi from Students for a Just Palestine and World Without War. They are sponsoring a screening of the documentary, The Palestine Exception, about the 2024 campus divestment movement, free speech and repression on campuses. It will be shown tonight on campus at 6. Joining me for that discussion will be Janet Parker from the Madison Rafa Sister City Project. So stay tuned to hear that interview as well. Stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back. Thank you. just about 10 minutes after 8, and joining me is Lindsay Kashgarian, the program director at the National Priorities Project, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And the National Priorities Project has released its annual tax day receipt highlighting exactly where 2024 income taxes went and what those numbers say about our national spending priorities. Hey, good morning, Lindsay Kashgarian. Good to have you.
Good morning, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know, this year, you know, the context is, you know, slightly different. We know that there's been a lot of efforts to cut programs and fire federal employees and some pretty essential services in order to, you know, pay for tax cuts for the wealthy, for instance. So it's in that context we're looking at our spending priorities. So can we just kind of start where your thinking started with this year's project? And then, you know, we'll jump into, you know, what we have paid for in terms of supporting weapons and war.
Yes. So as you mentioned at the opening, we do this tax receipt every year. But this year is a little bit different. And this year we were really thinking about two big things when we put together the tax receipt. One was, as you mentioned, you know, government services being shut down, programs being shut down, federal employees being fired, all supposedly in the name of saving money. But then we thought, okay, how much are those programs that are being shut down actually costing us in the first place? And how much are we paying for things where they actually want to put in more money, like the Pentagon and mass deportations? So that was thing number one. And thing number two was that, of course, we still have a cost of living crisis. We're still seeing the price of eggs go up, the opposite of what we were promised. And so what we decided to do was to compare all of these things on your tax receipt, how much you paid for these government programs versus the cost of eggs.
Yes, at about an average of $5.90.
That's right. Yes. And in fact, they have actually gotten more expensive since we did this just a few weeks.
So, you know, I think I talked about war, but let's talk about the things that have been cut and maybe also then put them side by side with other expenses. So, for instance, USAID, right, the International Aid Program, that provides life-saving food and medical help to millions. The amount we pay is about 6 dozen eggs.
That's right.
How much does that amount to from our federal tax bill to support, you know, a life-saving program?
Yeah, so USAID, of course, is the international aid program. It did a lot of things. One of the famous parts it's most famous for is the AIDS program that provided life-saving HIV medication to people all over the world. It's been estimated that shutting down USAID, as the Trump administration has done, could cost 6 million lives in the coming years unless we reinstate that aid. And so for that, the average taxpayer last year paid just $39, as you said, the equivalent of about 6 dozen eggs. And it's a tremendous amount of aid for the world and truly life-saving for children and for people around the world for just $39 for the average taxpayer. And then I'll just note that another little piece of that, out of that, only just $2 of the USAID funding was going to climate aid. And of course, we know there are places around the world that are suffering even more from the climate crisis and extreme weather events and flooding and all of these things than people in the United States are, and have fewer resources to deal with it. So we're putting very small amounts of money into these things that they're shutting down. And clearly, if you compare it to things where we're actually paying quite a bit of money, like for war and weapons, where the average taxpayer paid over $3,700 last year, they haven't cut that. So that's where the money is, and that's not what they're cutting.
And they're going to request more, right?
And they're going to request more, yes.
So we're going to circle back to that. I do want to make the comparison, because these things have actually been cut. How much of the federal income tax went to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. You mentioned climate change.
Yes. So I think this is one of the things that's gotten the most attention. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So they do two really critical things. They do climate research and they do weather forecasts. And of course, when we have, you know, increasing frequency of tornadoes and flooding and increasing severity of those events and storms and all of the things that all of your listeners already know about, we have that happening, and they're cutting funding for those predictions that can give people a chance to get out of it, and for climate research that gives us a chance to better understand what's actually happening to our climate as we continue to emit fossil fuels. So for that, the average taxpayer last year paid just $25.
So when you're doing this report and you're, you know, you must be reacting to, you know, you might have some idea over time because it's been, you know, annually compiled. It's still shocking. I mean, some of these, it's $1.88 for a taxpayer for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that they want to cut.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, there are so many programs that they've targeted that just really don't make any sense if they're interested in actually saving money. So another one is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And this is an agency that is relatively recently established. And the point of it is just to stop consumers from being scammed. That's all it is. That was less than $3 per taxpayer, and they're attacking that. They have announced an intention to eliminate a homelessness program that cost taxpayers just one penny last year.
And folks,
so clearly, that's not saving us real money, but it will make a real difference to the unhoused people who are depending on services.
One penny for the Interagency Council on Homelessness that coordinates across agencies and into the states to end homelessness. No eggs, just one penny.
That's right, just one penny, yes. Yes, so most of us, very few of us would miss that penny, but it's certainly going to be missed by the people who are depending on it. They've also attacked the Postal Service. They have expressed interest in privatizing that. That costs the average taxpayer less than $4. And the Postal Service is the only reliable means of sending communication or sending packages, especially to a lot of rural communities in this country. It's the only service that reliably delivers everywhere it has to, and for the same price everywhere. So that's, you know, if you compare it to UPS or FedEx or any of the for-profit alternatives, there's just no contest, especially if you're in a rural location.
Lindsay, I have to say $1.43 for museums and libraries, $1.03 for the National Labor Relations Board.
Yes.
You know, it's just important to defend these at such affordable costs, I guess you could say. Meanwhile, there are programs that are more expensive but vital. At $149, the National Institutes of Health, but so important relative to $3,700 for war and weapons.
That's right. So $149 for the National Institutes for Health. That is, you know, that is certainly more significant than some of these other things we've been talking about. But remember that this is the federal government agency that funds things like cancer research. And it's funds things like research into rare diseases, where pharmaceutical companies, which is the other alternative, have no incentive to look for cures for rare diseases because they'll never turn a profit. So the NIH does things that are critical. It provides money for basic research for cancer and things where pharmaceutical companies also have no incentive because the profit that they could possibly earn is so far down the road. And the NIH does all of that. Meanwhile, that's $149, as you said, for the average taxpayer. But people paid more than twice that, $388 for the top five Pentagon contractors. Just five companies that have contracts with the Pentagon.
Yeah, I want to talk about that spending, and then let's say compare it to the About $1,800 spent for Medicaid, which is on the chopping block. But let's talk more about those kinds of expenses, right? The money towards the Pentagon, of which contractors include Elon Musk.
That's right. Contractors include Elon Musk, and Elon Musk stands, his company, SpaceX, that receives Pentagon contracts, stands to gain many more contracts. In fact, has already signed new deals with this administration since they took office, and stands to gain a lot more, including from other agencies, not just the Pentagon. They also have NASA contracts, but the average taxpayer paid almost $6 in just Pentagon contracts for Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, last year. And that's not a lot of money, but it is standing to grow, and it's standing to grow because Musk is in this position with the administration where he's exercising real power over which agencies stay open and which agencies get to keep their funding. And so far, as I said, the Pentagon has not been hit by serious cuts. There's been some reporting in the news about cuts at the Pentagon, but those cuts would all be just turned around and the money put back into the Pentagon for other programs. So they want to shift how they're spending some of their money, but they're not going to get less.
You know, and you know, they aren't that reliable exactly on their record keeping, correct? They still fail to pass their audit.
Yes. So the Pentagon is the only major federal agency that has never passed a financial audit. That means that they aren't able to account for their assets. It means they have many billions of dollars in equipment and things that are unaccounted for that they can't explain what they have or where it is or what they've done with it. And that's, like I said, the only federal agency that has never passed an audit. And they have admitted that they're not close to passing an audit. So there have been in the past legislative attempts to stop them from getting budget increases or even give them small budget cuts until they're able to pass pass that audit. But none of those have been successful.
And so this is the money they get, but we don't really know exactly if this is what they spent it on.
We don't know exactly where it went, and they don't know exactly where it went.
Okay. So again, the average taxpayer in their federal income tax paid $3,707 for the Pentagon contractors, including SpaceX and Elon Musk. And what else is included in that?
So as you said, it's over $3,700 for war and weapons. That includes the Pentagon and Pentagon contractors. The average taxpayer paid over $1,400, $1,430 for all Pentagon contractors last year, versus less than half that, just $610 for military personnel, so for the troops. Yes. So you can see where the money is going in the Pentagon, I think, from that quite clearly. And then it also includes things like nuclear weapons. That was $115 for the average taxpayer last year. It includes $88 in aid to foreign militaries. That's money that the Pentagon gets from Congress, from our tax dollars, and sends to militaries in other countries. It also includes $43 for the F-35 jet fighter, which your listeners may know is a program that has gone far over budget and experienced many problems, including spontaneously catching fire at least three times on record.
And just 37 cents, no eggs, for DEI programs in the Pentagon.
Yes, that's right. And that is the one area of the Pentagon that Musk and this administration have targeted for cuts is DEI programs. And that was just, like you said, 37 cents.
And another category separate from that is immigration border control, right?
Yes, that is separate. And for that, the average taxpayer last year paid almost $100, $98 for deportations and border patrol. And what's really significant about that is that this administration is looking to spend far more on those things. Of course, mass deportations is the president's probably signature policy initiative for this administration, and we've already seen all of the horrible things that your listeners know go wrong with that, including, you know, wrongly deporting people who were supposed to have legal protection, putting people into detention who had green cards and are being detained because they exercised their free speech, which does apply as a right to people in this country, even if they aren't citizens. And so we've seen all of those things happen. And that's something that they want to spend a lot more money on. And we'll continue to see more mass deportations and of people who are, you know, have been in this country for years, who are parts of their communities, who have families. And that's something where they're looking to spend significantly more money.
And there we have $26 for refugee assistance.
That, yes,
has been currently frozen.
Yes, so almost four times as much for deportations and Border Patrol as for refugee assistance. And as you said, this is your tax receipt for last year. So this doesn't reflect what's happening right now. And as you said, they have frozen refugee assistance now, with the possible exception of they've said that they'll welcome refugees who are white Afrikaners from South Africa, who there's a whole history there. But of course, the big history is apartheid in South Africa. And so they've decided that the one category of refugee that they're interested in helping is white people from South Africa.
Okay. So I'm looking, so if you log on to the National Priorities Project website, you can see the average federal income taxes paid by us. And then you can do it by state. So in Wisconsin, the amount is slightly less than the average. I'll stick with the national average. It is higher than the Wisconsin average is actually a little bit lower than the national average. But I'll go with the national average because these numbers are important. The average person spends something like $15,000 a year in through their payroll deduction and in income tax and whatever and whatnot. So $1,823 goes for Medicaid, $445 does go for food stamps. And these are a priority. I mean, I think for, and I want to add the context because a tax cut of these would only save, by your calculation, for about the bottom half of the income scale, $1 per day, while the richest would pocket 1%, which is $314,266 per year,
yes.
Versus $365, $1 per day. So, you know, can you just talk about that stark contrast? Yes, these are important programs and these numbers are important, but still might seem large. But what a tax cut would it really, you know, help people if they cut these programs? Wherever you want to start.
Yes, so it's a good question. So yes, Medicaid is one of the more expensive things on the tax receipt, and food stamps as well. It's, you know, I would start by pointing out that there are 70 million people in this country who depend on Medicaid for their health insurance, and it's lower income people and it's older people who Medicaid can cover things for them that Medicare can't. It's, you know, it's children, it's families. So 70 million people in this country depend on Medicaid as their source of health insurance. And they're planning to cut it quite significantly. They're planning to put essentially half of those people at risk of losing their health coverage. And then for food stamps, there are 40 million people in this country who depend on food stamps. And remember, you know, this is for food. This is to keep people alive. So it's about the most basic function that the government could have. Is when people are struggling, is to give help with that. The other thing I'd point out about is that all of these numbers on the tax receipt are average. And so if for folks whose income is lower than average, they'll be paying less for these things. So, you know, for a low-income person who's listening to this or a struggling person, they're not paying the full amount that's shown on our tax receipt for these things.
The National Priorities Project report, and they have a kind of takeaway short sheet, but a more detailed version at the website that you can also look at. And it seems to me that maybe they could have a checklist. I don't know. Maybe not, because we don't know who cares about what these days. But it is important to know where our money's going while there's all this slashing of money, but now more than ever, right?
Yes, yes, it is. It is very important. And we do know, you know, that the checklist is an interesting idea, but we do have polling about federal budget priorities. And so we know that most people would prefer to shift money away from the Pentagon and into things like programs for housing and food and education and basic government services that help people in this country live and thrive. So we do know that. Unfortunately, of course, that is not what this administration and this Congress is prioritizing right now.
Lindsay Kashgarian, that time flew by. She is the program director at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I check out this information at the National Priorities Project website. Lindsay, it was great to talk with you this morning. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much, Jan.
Coming up, Professor James Leary, so stay tuned. It is 8:32, and I here with me in the studio is James Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies. I know many of you know Jim over the years here at WORT. He is here in the studio. And what's really interesting, Jim, there's so many ways I'm thinking about this morning, but he represents, Professor Leary represents the American Folklore Society on the advisory board for the National Recording Registry, which is part of the Library of Congress, right?
Yes.
Which, by the way, its librarian is a presidential appointee, the current librarian appointed by President Obama. And I wanted to talk with him about that whole kind of how that all works in these times. But the Library of Congress announced this year's, I'm going to call them their class, their 25 entries to the National Recording Registry. And among the entries were Harry Urata's recordings of Japanese immigrant cane cutters in Hawaii and the first Asian American entries to the registry. Also in the 2025 class, the Hawaiian Quintet's influential 1913 recording of Queen Liliuokalani's Aloha Oi. So, hey, good morning, Jim. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Jan, it's a pleasure to be here.
Sorry, but I just shrunk my page to about, I don't know, maybe one size font. I don't know what's going on here. But, you know, our paths cross in interesting ways over the years. And I need to check myself on this particular class and Rata's selection into the registry, because it's kind of emotional for me. Urata is a Nisei, my father Nisei, and the cane cutter songs are of the grandparents, the Issei, and so it sort of resonates inside of my bones, actually. But before then, I got to talk politics. So tell me, you are a professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies, and you represent the American Folklore Society on the advisory board for the National Recording Registry of the Library of Congress. And so where do I start?
Yeah.
Who else is on the advisory board? Maybe I'll start with that.
Yeah, there are. The advisory board was established early in this century. And there are representatives from professional societies like the American Folklore Society, Society for Ethnomusicology, music librarians, musicologists. But there are also people from the Grammy Foundation and the Country Music Hall of Fame and audio engineers associations and songwriters associations. So there's a cross-section of professionals and industry people as well, and some, well, that's kind of what it is. And yeah, go ahead.
Other university folks, other academics?
Some are, but there are other people, you know, who are Grammy-winning audio engineers, or they're songwriters who've, you know, done stuff for country or pop artists. They're copyright lawyers who work for record labels. They're working musicians in different genres. So it's the kind of cross section that you would want for selecting these 25 annual entries.
So it is sort of important to me when you notified me when you learned of this inclusion. I did send it home because people knew about this, and it was important to them, and it was sort of personal in that way. How do you end up on the National Recording? I mean, to me, you mentioned Grammy winners, but I think you're more of a rock star, but nevertheless, you know?
Yeah, I got 2 Grammy nominations, but I didn't win. But I've done research, yeah. And
the important documentation, notes, and for people to understand the context of the music,
yeah,
is so important.
Yeah. So I've worked on music and folk song related kinds of projects since the 1970s, and the American Folklore Society gets two representatives, and when one of them rotated off, I was asked to be on it. So this is beginning my 5th year on the advisory board.
I can only imagine what that's like, what that meeting is like. Could be very, very cool. Okay, so how do you, what are the selection criteria?
Well, these are supposed to be recordings that were made at least 10 years ago, and they're supposed to be of historical and or cultural significance. And the members of the registry self-select onto different kinds of interest groups. So there are, you know, some who look at sports broadcasting, and there's some that look at pop music between 1955 and 75. And but there also are field recording interest groups, and also folk and ethnic interest groups. And I'm part of those, along with a couple of other ones. And so we start caucusing, you know, a couple of months before we all meet in Washington, D.C., which happens in early December. And we come up with a first, or sometimes a first and a second set of recordings that we want to pitch, and then we have to do a little write-up. And when we meet for, you know, one day, and we get about, you know, 5 minutes where you kind of make your pitch. And then in the aftermath, everyone does ranked choice voting for their top 25. So if you put something as number one, that's 25 points, and your 25th ranking gets 1 point, and that's tallied. We don't get to see what the tally is, but that's given to the Librarian of Congress, who consults with some of her staff. And then, you know, we have voted in January roughly, and we get the word sometime in early April, and so it was a big exciting surprise for me.
So who makes I guess do you submit people for this year? I guess you submit people or music in certain categories. How many of those are, and is it by the advisory group that makes it, or is it open? Because I think it's open, right?
Well, when I look at the public website. The public can make public nominations, and we look at those carefully, and they're also considered by the Library of Congress and her staff, and sometimes the public nominations coincide with those that are a particular interest groups are also advancing. So there's a kind of a combination of, so-called experts or insiders or what have you, and members of the general public, along with the Librarian of Congress, who with her staff kind of looks at the big picture, so to speak.
Now, the more context, and especially in these times, the Library of Congress, it's the librarian, the chief librarian appointed by the president. It is our national library, our national collection. And inside of this is the National Recording Registry. Tell us even more about how important that is in terms of knowledge, preservation of culture, inclusion, diversity.
Yeah. Well, the United States, has an astonishing heritage of recorded sound going back to the 1890s, range from, spoken word to different kinds of music from many, many different kinds of traditions. And part of the mission of the Library of Congress, of course, is to preserve this material, to raise consciousness about it, to be aware of elements of our audio heritage that may be endangered, and also to highlight some of the stellar or consequential performances that have been recorded over time. And so it's part of their mission, in the same way that there's a national film registry that that recognizes filmmaking, for example.
So these recordings, maybe existed in sort of for posterity inside of the Smithsonian Museum, right? Is that
they're in different repositories. Some are held by the Library of Congress. Others are held by by other archives, possibly the Smithsonian Institution, which holds the Harry Urata collection. Yeah. And Dave Walker, their audio archivist, did the transfer from the original reel tape to digital format. But these recordings exist in different places.
This may not seem interesting to people, but bear with me, folks. So then you sent me this thing about Dave Walker, who is the audio archivist at the Smithsonian. Yeah. Like, that's amazing. Like, what would you say he does?
Well,
and it's important. I think this is all so important, especially in these times, to, like, totally. I just think it's.
Well, the Smithsonian. Since the 1960s, there's been a festival of American folklife, and many folklorists, myself included, have done field research in different parts of the country to bring people there, and oftentimes that includes audio recordings as well as reports and field notes and transcriptions or indexes, summaries of recordings, and so you've got someone who's got to keep track of all that material. And then also the Smithsonian became the recipient of the Folkways record label after its founder died, and so it keeps those. Mo Ash wanted all of his Folkways recordings to be kept in print in perpetuity, and the Smithsonian has taken that on and issued new recordings under that Smithsonian Folkways label as well.
Oh, good. And just going back, I think it's just $1.03 from our taxpayer bill to support these museums. But anyway, This inclusion of the Urata recordings. So the story, if those of you want to learn more, there's a PBS Hawaii documentary co-produced by the UH Hawaii West Oahu Center for Labor Education and Research in PBS Hawaii called Canefield Songs, Hole, Hole Bushi. And then also Franklin Odo's book, Voices from the Canefields. I got a question about how you make the submission. It looks like you had one page in 11-point font with 1-inch margins, and you had one paragraph that I'm going to keep for instruction for writing short. You include the significance of Urata's documentary recordings. You talk about Franklin Odo. You talk about Juliana Chang, the American poet and scholar, and who writes about Cantonese rhymes from Chinatown. And you mention Fred Ho in one paragraph. I'm keeping this for how it is a magnificent paragraph. But can you tell us about? I mean, is this how short a submission has to be, or could you have written much more?
They're pretty short. I've done an expanded version that will soon be up on the National Recording Registry site with some links, and also a mention of the film that PBS Hawaii produced, which is freely available on, it's up on YouTube, and it's well worth watching, a short 26 minute film.
So for me, the essay were pictures and sounds. And so, I'd seen a lot of pictures, and I have a memory of sounds, right? And so Harry Minoru Urata, he's in the 1917 to 2009, about the time frame of my dad, Nisei, who had been interned at the Honouliuli internment camp on Oahu, and then after that seeks out these songs of the Iseis, which is... this is stuff that makes cousins of mine, we're all sansei, weep. Because these are songs, why do songs like this in the genre, right? They just, even if you don't know what they're saying.
Yeah, these were powerful songs. And I'm always looking for what's missing from the registry. And fortunately, thanks to Franklin Odo's work and the Smithsonian digitizing these materials and doing a finding aid, I learned about them and looked into them some more and, tried to make a pitch for them because they're so powerful. They're like field hollers of African Americans. They're like, I've done a little field recording with Hmong in Wisconsin who have adapted old courtship songs and New Year's songs to express, being alone, far from home, their hopes and dreams. Other immigrants, many immigrants from Europe in the 19th and early 20th century bring up similar themes. So this is part of, what America is, this transformation of people from one place to another and just dealing with the whole ambiguity and challenges of it all. And there had not been an Asian American inclusion, and here was this extraordinary collection, and the time was right for it to be recognized.
Our paths have just intersected over the decades, and now I know why. people are aware of Hole Hole Bushi. But that this ends up in the Library of Congress, I think, I guess I should track this down if Harry Urata has, he has children. I don't know.
I don't know either. Actually, he taught at University of Minnesota for a while.
Yeah, and that's really weird because there was a Japanese language school that the military sent people to. So I'm thinking he crossed into my people because they had, taught at the Japanese language school there too, because they spoke Japanese. They weren't professors. They were people in the military. But anyhow, I didn't know how much I was going to break down during this interview, or at least share personally. But it is important to me that you thought of including this and to talk about it, to let people know about it, to tell you I appreciated your paragraph, and to tell people that they are now taking nominations for next year's class.
Correct.
So that's really important because we want to tear down the walls here, right?
Yeah. If one searches National Recording Registry, there's an option on the landing page for not nominate something. And sometime in the early fall, those of us who are on the advisory board will start to get tallies of those nominations. So, just for example, last year, Viola Turpinen, a Finnish American accordionist who played all across the upper Midwest at little workers' halls and so forth, she was finally entered into the registry. And part of that had to do with a grassroots effort by Finnish Americans who recognized just how influential a performer she was. Yeah. And in a curious way, a leading Finnish ethnomusicologist, Pekka Gronau, suggested that I also nominate Lili Okalani's Aloha Oi as recorded by the Hawaiian Quintet.
Oh, this went by fast. We're going to have to talk again.
Yeah, it's okay.
Jim, you write about Harry Urata, 1917 to 2009, documenting the Hawaiian plantation songs of the late 19th and early 20th century. And you write, like many immigrant workers, they had adopted older haiku-like folk songs, the bushi to new circumstances, some verses tempered on separation with hope, others like African American blues were songs of pain. I direct people to look for these. Thank you to your audio guide, Smithsonian, who gave us some clips.
Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, Dave Walker. Again, you can just learn more about it. Look at Franklin Oda's book, the PBS. And the registry is open now for nominations. I got to say, so long. We're going to, and we didn't get to talk about the second nomination, Hawaiian music. Became quite popular actually in the U.S. And the Hawaiian Quintet's influential 1913 recording of Queen Lili Okalani's, and we could talk about her and what happened there, Aloha Oi, but we'll just play that as we say so long this morning. Thanks, Jim. You'll be back. Jim Leary of Mount Horeb. Thank you.
You're welcome. Great to see you, Jan. Thank you.
Sorry, we have to, but we've got Carla, and we want to get to Carla Rotunde from Students for Just Palestine and World Without War. By phone with me in the studio is Janet Parker from the Madison Rafa Sister City Project.
Not quite.
Oh, World Without War?
But, Madison for a World Beyond War.
Oh, well, there you go.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
Students for Just Palestine all the time, though.
And Students for Just Palestine and World Without War being the lead sponsors of the film that's going to be shown on campus this evening at 6 p.m. at the Union. Look for the location when you get.
It's in the chart room, which is in the lower level.
Yeah.
And room number is B147, the chart room at the Memorial Union.
Thank you. Hey, Carla, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Carla Rotunde from Students for Just Palestine, and I believe World Without War as well. Can you tell us about why this screening, the documentary, The Palestine Exception, is really important. I can't understate that.
Yeah, so I think it's really important for students also to have conversations around it. So this is a very discussion-based event, but the film is discussing the repression of academic freedom and freedom of speech on campuses, and talking about different policies implemented by university institutions, especially against pro-Palestine campus protesters calling for the disinvestment from Israel. And so we'll be having discussions. Anybody with any viewpoint is welcome to join, but we'll be looking at the legacies of McCarthyism and what it means to have free speech, especially on university campuses.
So can you tell us about the filmmakers? And this film is being shown, it's on a tour right now. If you log on to there's a website for the film and by the filmmakers, you can see that. But can you tell us about this particular filmmakers? What do you know about them?
Yeah, this is also done in collaboration with the Film Independent sponsorship. And filmmakers also cover history of talking with different academic disciplines and interview-based, and also looking at some live coverage.
I want to make the point.
I'm excited for the film. Yeah, go ahead.
It's brand new. This is about the student encampments last year.
Yes.
So here we are a year out, and with encampment just beginning at Yale again last night. In response to Ben Gavir going to speak off campus at Yale, and the students were setting up an encampment last night. So a year ago, of course, here at UW-Madison and at hundreds of colleges and universities, we saw the most robust anti-war, anti-genocide movement that the United States has seen in 50 years. And we just revere the student organizers, and this film is talking about them. The student organizers, the faculty and staff, and the response of repression on campus. The film is electric. You must see this film.
It's a serious film by serious filmmakers on a serious topic.
Yes, the director and producer, I'm sorry, I realized I didn't fully answer the question that you had asked. So Jan Hacken is the director and producer of this film and is a professor of psychology at Portland State University. And is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. So it brings in a lot of voices from Portland State University, but this film applies to students all over wherever encampments have incurred or just where freedom of speech has been repressed.
The goal is to promote discussion. All viewpoints are invited. Who's going to... There'll be a post-viewing discussion, right?
Yes, correct. We'll have Samir Alatout, Dahlia, and Abby will be, which are two students, and Samara Latut is a professor. Dahlia Saba and Abby Klein will be student leaders, also leading the discussion.
Now, Janet, was it important to support the students' showing of this film? Was it controversial to show it at Yale or here, or was it less so?
Well, I haven't heard controversy about showing it here. The Student World Beyond War group and Students for Justice in Palestine co-sponsored it, so they, you know, booked the room. The speakers are going to be great, and as discussion based, we're not going to just show the film and then have the discussion. The students are going to stop the film several times and have discussion throughout. So it'll be lively.
But to have support from outside non-student groups is, I think, these kind of partnerships and allies are needed at
thank
this
you.
Time.
And let me thank Madison Veterans for Peace, because they actually foot the bill for showing this. So,
Carla, you know, can you talk about why you're doing this and your concerns as a part of Students for Just Palestine?
Hi, yeah. As I'm doing this, I think it's really important to make sure that other students know, especially students who weren't here for during the time of the encampment, or just to be knowing about the types of repression that University of Wisconsin has been taking, making arbitrary claims and punishing students for supposedly doing advocacy, which is our student right to do, and just not even for students, our citizens' right or residents' right. So I think that's really important for us as students to be talking about and to connect to what has happened in the past, also to inform how we want to be building a world and what we want to be working towards as we continue our studies.
Carla Rotundi is with Students for Just Peace, World Without War, Janet Parker as well. And I saw this, I wanted to make sure we let people know. I was so appreciative that you were willing to be on the air for just a bit of time this morning. The film is at 6 p.m. tonight at the UW Memorial Union room.
Chart room.
And
lower
you know,
level.
Thank you for coming in. I know
yeah,
we
community
had,
members, come out. Let's yes. support the students. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you. Thank you, Carla. And thank you, Dave Lawrenson and Miss Tina, our music producer and engineer and receptionist this morning. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's 8 o'clock. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM. Madison, coming up next in Surgery Radio Kiosk. And then Bill and Bobby are going to take us back to the country, so stay tuned.
This is Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 23rd.
Donald Trump has never been able to comprehend the plain fact that when a person says no, that actually means no. His view is that his every desire should be met with surrender, even if that requires applying force. This explains a lot about his crude approach to Greenland, demanding that the Danish territory simply succumb to him. Even though proud Greenlanders have repeatedly said go away to Trump's uninvited advances, their emphatic rejections have only heightened his sadistic lust for dominance. Indeed, rebuffed again this month, he turned downright sinister, declaring, "One way or another, we're going to get it." Why push so fiercely for a frozen Arctic island that has a population smaller than Greenville, South Carolina? First, because Donald is an overprivileged child with an insatiable need to assert power over others. The pragmatic reason, though, is money. Beneath that thick covering of ice, Greenland has a trove of oil, uranium, precious metals, etc., that Trump and his billionaire cohorts desperately want to plunder. Initially, Trump and company tried macho American chauvinism to get their way.